Why didn't they organize an underground movement and leave a printed record of their opposition, which could be referred to now? They never made such a record, and they have nothing to refer to, because they were not revolutionists. They were not opponents of the regime which they now condemn. The truth is that they were the hand-picked accomplices of Stalin, and they owe their careers and their privileges to him and his regime. They want to blame everything now on Stalin as an individual. There is nothing Marxist in such an explanation of any social regime. The fact is that the Stalin regime, like every other, had a social basis. Stalin was the representative of the Soviet bureaucracy. Many people, including Khrushchev and company, enjoyed rich benefits and privileges under the rule of Stalin. Not everybody was hungry. Not everybody was chained to his job and refused permission to change it. Not everybody was sent to slave labor camps, although there were millions and millions of them. Some of them grew fat under Stalin. Some of them drove automobiles and lived in summer cottages and enjoyed all the fruits of the labor of the heroic Russian working class. They were the ones who supported Stalin, and they were well satisfied with his regime, and they supported it in all its crimes. The privileged beneficiaries of the Stalin regime numbered millions in the Soviet Union. There was not one man alone. There were millions of privileged people tied to that regime and prospering under it. Khrushchev's explanation explains nothing of what really happened. Their method today is the same as their method yesterday, turned upside down. Yesterday, Stalin was pictured as a superman, as the infallible, benevolent leader who could make no mistake and do no wrong, who was responsible for all progress and all victories in the Soviet Union, in peace and in war. Today, the same Stalin is represented as a paranoid criminal who was personally responsible for all the mistakes which brought the Soviet Union to the brink of ruin all by himself. The great man theory is simply replaced by the devil theory, the other side of the same coin. The devil is dead, but the privileged bureaucrats still live. They remain in power in the Soviet Union, and don't you forget that. And their sole concern is to stay in power and hang on to their privileges at the expense of the working masses in the Soviet Union, who are our concern. Why do these bureaucrats speak out now, 3 years after the death of Stalin, and begin to tell a part about that terrible regime, a part of the truth? Is it because they have suddenly turned honest and are no longer afraid? Some people are asking you to believe that, but they are liars and deceivers. There have been some concessions and some reforms, no question about that. But there has been no basic change in the bureaucratic regime of special privileges for a minority and hard times for the majority established under Stalin. The bureaucracy still has the privileges, and the workers have no rights and no freedom whatever. And anybody who says they do lies. There is no such thing as a free worker in the Soviet Union under Khrushchev, any more than there was under Stalin. That has yet to come. got to get that freedom for themselves. I think many of you who are present in this hall know the great reputation of I.F. Stone, the distinguished journalist who used to write for the New York Compass and the New York Post. An iconoclast who never buckled to the witch hunt, who came out in defense of the civil rights of the communists, of James Kucher and the Trotskyists and everybody else persecuted under it, who participates in all activities of a United Front character in defense of civil rights and civil liberties with Stalinists or Trotskyists or socialists or whoever may be involved, has a great reputation for integrity as a journalist, and justly earned. I.F. Stone went over to Russia after the 20th Congress to take a look for himself. And because he had always been considered, and justly so, as friendly to the Soviet Union, many people were expecting and hoping that he would send back a favorable and perhaps a whitewash report that everything is lovely now. He had been a critic of the Moscow trials and the suppression of civil liberties in the slave labor camps. He never went for that before. They thought he would say everything is better now. He came back and he wrote a terrible series of articles of disillusionment in his paper called I.F. Stone's Weekly. In my opinion, he went too far in his economic characterization. But he hit the nail on the head when he described the political situation. He summed it up in one sentence for the benefit of people who want to deceive themselves that everything has been cured in the Soviet Union. I.F. Stone simply said this: "This is not a good regime, and it is not run by honest men." Now, if Khrushchev and company know, Khrushchev and company are the same bureaucrats, the same cynical careerists they were when they served Stalin, and climbed into high office over a mound of corpses of better men than they are. They have not turned honest and they are still afraid, but they are afraid now not of the dead Stalin, but of the living wrath of the Soviet masses who have been so long oppressed and who have begun to rise against their oppression. The irresistible pressure of the Soviet workers was the power behind the 20th Congress, and that, comrades, is the key to the understanding of what is taking place. The bureaucrats assembled at that Congress had warning signals of a coming storm, and they began to respond to these signals. Remember the uprising of the German workers in June 1923, the East German workers. That was followed a month later by a general strike in the forced labor camps of Berkuta. These tremendous actions under the guns of police state terror, when workers took their lives in their hands to strike, gave notice of the first revolution, of the political revolution that is brewing against Stalin, as the general strikes in the spring of 1905. Gave notice of the first revolution against the Tsar. Khrushchev and company want to exculpate themselves. They want to throw off the blame and escape the consequences of the people's hatred and the people's wrath. I do not say this to minimize the importance of what has been said and done at the 20th Congress, or to pass it off as if nothing had happened. No. Great things indeed are happening in the Soviet Union these days, and their importance becomes magnified if we see them in their true light as a reflection reflection, a distorted reflection, in the top circles of the privileged bureaucracy, of a profound movement from below, a movement of the oppressed Soviet workers, a revolutionary movement for the overthrow of the privileged bureaucracy and the restoration of Soviet democracy. That's what the Soviet workers mean when they shout ever louder and louder, "Back to Lenin." The slogan "Back to Lenin" was the slogan of the left opposition in the 20s and the 30s. That's the slogan of the Berkuta strike in 1953. And that's the slogan of the Soviet workers today. No wonder the bureaucrats assembled at the Congress also gave three cheers for the slogan "Back to Lenin." Back to Lenin and nothing less is what the Soviet workers really demand. And they demand the substance and not merely the form. We put all our faith in this revolutionary movement of the Soviet workers, and no faith whatever in the good intentions of the bureaucratic heirs of Stalin. I think the best way to muddle up the discussion of the new events and the worst crime against the truth in the discussion opening up now is to say that the Soviet bureaucrats have already reformed themselves or are in the process of doing so, that they have mellowed, and that they all they need is to be let alone to bring about a gradual elimination of all the hated features of Stalinism and the reinstitution of a democratic workers' regime. If they are trusted and left alone, everything will remain basically the same. These bureaucrats are the privileged upper crust. They will never give up their privileges voluntarily. They have to be overthrown like every other privileged group in history have to be overthrown. Trotsky said on this subject 20 years ago in his great book, The Revolution Betrayed, "No tiger ever yet cut off its own claw. They have to be trimmed by others." We can be confident that the Russian masses will not let the bureaucrats alone to reform themselves. We can be confident that the changes now taking place in the Soviet Union represent not the end, but the beginning of a revolutionary transformation that will sweep out the last remnants of Stalinism. The political revolution against the privileged bureaucrats has nothing in common with the dreams and hopes of imperialists of a capitalist counter-revolution. That's not what's on the order of the day in the Soviet Union. The political revolution against the privileged bureaucrats will not bring the return of capitalism. On the contrary, just the contrary. In the final analysis, it is the only sure way to prevent the return of capitalism in the Soviet Union, to let the workers assume once again the real political power. That's the way Trotsky explained it 20 years ago in the book I have mentioned. His theoretical exposition has burning actuality for all of us who want to follow this question and its further development in these days. Now, if we reject Khrushchev's claim that he and his associates did not tell the truth before because they were afraid for their lives, what shall we say about the leaders of the American Communist Party, who hid the truth about the Stalin regime from their own members and from the readers of their press? All these many years, what were they afraid of? Why, the most they stood to lose was their positions and their false importance as little Stalins. To be sure, if they had told the truth, they would have been slandered, they would have been expelled, they would have been denounced as fascist spies and counter-revolutionists. But it's possible to survive all that if you have some integrity and some courage. We proved that for 27 years. The skins of the American Stalinist leaders, whatever they may be worth, weren't in very great danger. The only thing they were afraid of was the truth, because the truth would have demolished all their claims to leadership. What I.S. Stone said about the Khrushchev regime can be said of the so-called Communist Party leadership in this country. This is not an honest party, and it is not run by honest men. That's a growing conviction in the rank and file of the Communist Party, growing so strong you even see it written in the Daily Worker letters column. They get so many letters stating that they have to print some. I want to make it very clear and explicit that I'm talking now about the official leaders of the Communist Party, and not about the honest communist workers whom they duped and deceived and betrayed. The American Stalinist leaders are apparently proceeding on the theory that confession is not only good for the soul, but also that it wipes out all responsibility for the crimes admitted. You merely have to say you were wrong, and then everything is cleared up. They say we were wrong. We defended all the crimes and all the lies of Stalin and Stalinism. We cheered for all the free-ups and all the murders of honest revolutionists. We denounced all who protested against the frame-ups and murders as counter-revolutionists and fascist spies. Our careers were built on lies. We're sorry. Now let's all get together and trust each other. That's the sum and substance of the propaganda of the leaders of the Communist Party since the 20th Congress in Moscow. But at more than one meeting of the Communist Party in recent days, CP members and sympathizers who have been duped and deceived so long have asked the question, how can we now trust anything you say? My opinion is you can, but you shouldn't. You shouldn't. It's not wise. When those careerist leaders of the Communist Party try to make a virtue of their claims that they're now correcting their mistakes merely by admitting some of them, they ought to be asked the simple question which was asked of a Stalinist speaker at a trade union conference in England, which I read in Bevan's speech. The trade unionist asked the Stalinist speaker, who had been explaining that they had made mistakes, but they're now correcting their mistakes. He asked him, how do you correct such a mistake as the frame-up and murder of innocents? The account I read didn't give the answer of the Stalinist speaker. I don't know what he said, but I imagine it would be very hard. You can be sure that in any discussion we take part in, looking toward the regroupment and reconstruction of an honest movement of revolutionary socialists in this country, that we will be on hand to ask such questions as that, and many more questions equally inconvenient for people who want to wipe a sponge over all the crimes of the past and pretend that the slate is now clean, that there's no more blood on it. The new program they are offering, I have been reading it in the Daily Worker, and nothing but Stalinism without Stalin, and Browderism without Browder. That's no good. One of the questions we want to ask at the start of the discussion among socialist-minded workers whom they've invited to take part in the discussion is something about a contradiction of their slogan. The 20th Congress says, back to Lenin, and the Communist Party of the United States is shouting, forward to the Democratic Party. Now you can't say both, or rather you can say both, but you can't do both at the same time. It's going in opposite directions. We, for our part, can't join the Democratic Party. If we have to have, if in order to have unity with these people, we have to join the Democratic Party, we're barred because we can't join. We are revolutionary socialists, not bourgeois Democrats. This Democrat Party is a capitalist party. Well, I knew that when I was 16 years old. I heard that explained by Eugene V. Debs. 50 years ago, the Democratic Party is a capitalist party just like the Republican Party. And the only difference between them is the difference between the gold dust twins. Take your choice, they're both the same, fundamentally. The Democratic Party is a capitalist party representing the interests of the bankers, the monopolists, and the Dixiecrats. Isn't that true? Well, let the bankers and the monopolists and the Dixiecrats have it. That's what we say. And let the workers organize a class party of their own. That was Lenin's idea. Anyone who wants to go back to Lenin can't escape the fact that Lenin assisted first of all and above all on a class party of the workers. He didn't ask them to join Milyukov's party in the Soviet Union, which is just as good as the Democratic Party of Stevenson in the United States. He said, organize the Workers' Party to overthrow this Milyukov gang. And even before Lenin, Karl Marx over 100 years ago said the workers should have a class party of their own. We're heartily in favor of a full and free discussion among all people and all tendencies friendly to the Soviet Union and professing devotion to the socialist ideas. We hope and believe that out of such a discussion, a full and free and unregulated discussion, can come a new understanding among honest socialist-minded people, and a new solidarity so long disrupted by Stalinism, and a regroupment in an honest party of American socialists. We, for our part, are ready and willing to contribute our part to bring about this new understanding and this new solidarity in a common struggle for a common cause. We don't demand that anybody take our word for it. We don't demand that anybody accept what we say out of hand. We are ready to listen as well as to speak, to learn as well as to teach. But after all the years of wholesale lying, misrepresentation, and terror brought into the movement by Stalinism, let us now have, for the first time in 30 years, a really free and honest discussion. Let us have old-fashioned forums and open debates where all points of view are fairly heard. Let us put all questions on the table and hear all opinions in a friendly way. Let the articles, pamphlets, and books of all sides be studied conscientiously. Let us agree to search together for the truth that will make us free. The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And let us search for this truth with free and independent minds as befits revolutionists. Each one thinking for himself and nobody taking anybody's word for it. That was the advice of Lenin long ago. That's the way he trained his Bolsheviks, to think independently, to know all sides of a subject, and make up their minds on the basis of independent inquiry. That was the advice of Lenin put in specific words, which we printed in the first issue of The Militant. When we began our struggle against Stalinism 28 years ago, in November 1928, Lenin's advice still holds good today, and it reads today as follows, as we printed it on the masthead of the first number of our Militant. I quote, "It is necessary that every member of the party should study calmly and with the greatest objectivity, first the substance of the differences of opinion, and then the development of the struggles within the party. Neither the one nor the other can be done unless the documents of both sides are published. He who takes somebody's word for it is a hopeless idiot who can be disposed of with a simple gesture of the hand." Those are the words of Lenin. Take nobody's word for it. Think for yourself. Study all points of view calmly and with the greatest objectivity. So said Lenin. Let that be the motto for the new discussion in the ranks of radical workers in this country. By that method, let us strive for a new understanding and a new solidarity and a new regroupment of all honest workers in a common struggle for a socialist America.
Suppressing this discussion.
young people and people not so young who have had no experience in political life except being a member of the Communist Party don't know what an atmosphere of free democratic discussion is. They have to get accustomed to it gradually. I think some who've come to this meeting might have had some questions to raise or maybe some arguments to make, but felt it was out of order because they were only in the audience and not on the floor. We've got to make up our minds that if we're ever going to clear up the movement in this country and get a new start with all honest forces cooperating, we've got to begin with free discussion. I mean really free discussion. Honestly considering all points of view, listening to each other talk, and trying to learn from each other. I hope tonight's meeting will be a down payment, a little installment, and a contribution to this creation of this new atmosphere among the various tendencies in the radical labor movement. I don't expect everybody to agree with everything I say. As long as I have the privilege of talking, that's all I have the right to demand, and you have the same right for yourself. Now, I noticed one comrade back there spoke, and I spotted him right away as a man who is not infected with religious superstition. He wants to know whether the slogan of religion is the opium of the people is being converted into the slogan religion is the oxygen of the people. Was that the question? Well, I know your point of view, and I am at somewhat of a disadvantage because for the first time in many years I am speaking in a church, and I don't exactly know what the etiquette is required. I don't want to be out of order, and at the same time I don't want to conceal my opinion that I have grave doubts of the efficacy of all other churches except possibly the Unitarian. That's just put in for safety's sake. The fact of the matter is, religion has been opposed by the Revolutionary Party in Russia in the early days, ideologically. Marx taught that religion is the opium of the people. That's the teaching of all followers of Marx, that religious superstition is incompatible with scientific thought. That doesn't mean that religion should be persecuted and ridiculed and so forth. At times in Russia, they went to the extreme of hooligan attacks against the religious people, of ridiculing them and so forth, and that found out that was not so successful. Many of the believers were offended by that and reacted unfavorably. In recent years, under Stalinism, Stalin, especially during the war, undertook, even revived the old Russian church and gave it some new privileges to use in the diplomatic on the diplomatic front throughout the world. But I don't know exactly what is the present policy of the Soviet Union. I see they have some religious leaders from Russia in the United States recently, just went back, I think, the other day. I don't see any reason to object to that at all. I believe under an absolutely pure and honest communist government, if the leaders of American churches want to come to visit Russia, they should let them come. If the church leaders in Russia want to travel around the world and visit other countries, they should be certainly allowed to do. Certainly, when we stand for freedom in the society, when we accomplish the socialist revolution, we're certainly going to inscribe on the banner free speech and free press, and that will certainly include freedom of religion. That certainly doesn't mean that the state will support religion or endow it, or that the leaders of the socialist proletariat will deprive themselves of the right of anti-religious propaganda, but that's as far as they will go. I think the formula that the socialist movement ought to inscribe on its banner in that respect, both in the press present and in the future is freedom for religious practice by anyone who has any ideas on the subject, whatever they may be, and freedom of anti-religious propaganda for people who don't believe in any religion, which includes me. That made the record clear on that point. And I hope that I'm permitted to make that statement under the principle of free speech without meaning any disrespect to the institution in which I'm speaking, and hoping there will be no unhappy consequences from the sky. You know, there was once an atheist professional anti-religious crusader in the old days. We used to call them Christ killers in the old days, who made a business going out soapboxing against religion and so forth. And one of these fellows was challenged to say, "Why don't you stand up and say, I defy God to strike me dead?" He said, "I don't believe in God, but I'm not going to say that because he might do it." So take note, I didn't make any such blasphemous statement. Now, a comrade here wanted to help me out, I think. A comrade member of our party asked, "What's the program of the SWP? But that's the subject of a whole lecture, and I wouldn't try to answer it in a few minutes. I'll say, in essence, it is this. The program of the Socialist Party is of Socialist Workers' Party. Oh, boy, what a difference one word can make, huh? I can make the difference between supporting an imperialist war or going to prison in opposition to it. Huh? What a difference that can make. Huh? The Socialist Workers' Party is a strictly Marxist organization founded on the basic principles of Marxism as laid down by the founders of scientific socialism, Marx and Engels, as developed by the great disciples of Marx and Engels, that's Lenin and Trotsky. That's the fundamental basis of the program of the Socialist Party. And its position on issues in this country all proceeds from the standpoint of the class struggle against class collaboration. Now, if you take that as a guiding line and are familiar, even roughly, with the great principles of scientific socialism, you can come pretty close to understanding what reaction our party will take to any question of the day. A strictly class struggle basis. That's why we won't go into the Democratic Party, because that's class collaboration. That's joining with a class enemy in a common party. That's against Marxism, against Lenin, against Trotsky, against common sense. We'll have nothing to do with that. Now, a comrade asked over here, didn't Lenin say we don't need a formal majority? The Communist Party is the vanguard of the working class, and it represents the majority, isn't that it? Well, now, Lenin didn't say it exactly that way. The great Marxists have never contended that we're going to be able to institute socialism by minority action. That's falsely attributed to us. In the Communist Manifesto, which is the foundation document of scientific socialism, everything begins there. All our great enlightening thought begins there. And it's too bad that we could have a single member of the socialist or radical movement who doesn't know the Communist Manifesto almost by heart. Because that's the starting point, the concentrated essence of the great thought of Marx and Engels over 100 years ago. Now, in the Communist Manifesto among us, that's where the principle of the class struggle is elucidated. Nobody could read the Communist Manifesto, the first document of scientific socialism, 108 years old. Nobody could ever read that and still pay any attention to advice to join and support the Democratic Party in this country. They simply don't mix, because the whole thesis of the Communist Manifesto is the class struggle, and that out of the class struggle of classes comes the transformation of society by the victory of the working class. And that every class struggle is a political struggle. And the political struggle can take the form only of parties. And the political struggle of the workers requires the organization of the workers' political party. When you advise workers to join the Democratic Party, you're advising just to turn exactly backward. That's the greatest prostitution. And I say, by God, the greatest betrayal of the young, well-meaning radical workers to teach them such criminal trash as saying you join with the Dixiecrat Party and the Capitalist Aristocrats Party and Henry Ford's Party and the party that led the American people into three wars within the memory of living people. You say, that's the party for me to join and hustle for. No, that's not the Communist Manifesto. That's not Marx. That's not Lenin. That's Dennis and Foster and Stalin, but not Lenin, not Marx. By God, I tell you what we ought to have some of these days. We want to have some real fun, some members of the Communist Party present here. Make a proposal in your organization to have me and one of your leaders debate that single question. Is it proper for communist workers to join and support the Democratic Party in this country? I'd love to do that, and I'd let him make the first speech and the summary and everything else. I'd be satisfied if he's got in a few words edgeways. But we won't have that debate yet. There has to be a little more pressure. These people talk about a free discussion, but they're scared to death of it. That's my opinion anyhow, and I hope I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, let me know, and we'll arrange the debate. Now, the Communist Manifesto, that's what I started to talk about. The Communist Manifesto says the movement for socialism is different from all, whereas all other revolutions in history have been movements of minorities in the interests of minorities. The socialist revolution is a movement of the immense majority in the interests of the immense majority. That's almost word for word from the Communist Manifesto. And that's essentially the meaning of the question. Now, Lenin lived in a country which was predominantly peasants, which was run not by a majority of the people, but by about one-tenth of a percent of the people. The Tsarist, the upper crust, and the nobility. The workers outnumbered that gang that was running the country. The great mass of the peasantry were mute and voteless. Lenin, in those conditions, said, "We'll overthrow this gang, providing we get the support of a majority of the working class with the support of the peasants." He didn't say the Communist Party is the minority and will take power, because when he went back to Russia in April 1917, the Communist Party was a small minority. And Kerensky and his gang were in power. You recall that. And what did Lenin write then? He wrote, and in the Pravda, he said, "We do not intend to overthrow this government. If they will give us our legal rights of propaganda, we will give a pledge not to do it. We think it's a bad government, and we want it to be changed, but for the time being, we limit ourselves to patient explanation until we gain a majority support of the working people." That's what Lenin said, and he didn't try a revolution in April, and he didn't try it in June or July. But by the time they came to November 7th, The Bolsheviks had the great majority of the working class in Petrograd and Moscow and the big centers supporting them. The small underground group of the Bolsheviks had become a great power because their slogans corresponded to the feeling and the interest of the great mass of the people. And Lenin cited all kinds of figures when they took over the power to prove by votes here and votes there that they had the majority. And when they got the majority of the working class, they said that's the majority of the of the people who count in this country, we'd take the power. But if they hadn't had this real majority, they couldn't have kept it. They couldn't have kept it. And it was clearly demonstrated that they had the active, conscious support of the majority of the working class in Russia and had the support of the peasantry, not in the same sense that the workers did it consciously and deliberately, but the sympathy and of the peasants and the refusal to rise against the regime assured their victory. And that's what we'll say in this country and every place else. We can't go around advocating minority revolutions. That's not Marxist. When we get a majority of the working people on our side, that's a majority of the population in this country, isn't it?